Hello and welcome to the Thinking Poker Podcast. I'm Andrew Brokus, and with me is Nate Mavis. Our guest today is going to be Jason Strasser. Jason is a name that you'll certainly recognize if you've been around the poker world for a while. He was a big online poker hero in, what was it, Nate, like 2005, 2006 era was kind of Jason's dominance?
Yeah, that sounds right. Maybe even as far back as 2004. I remember when I joined 2+2 and started posting, I think he was already a big name. He was, in 2005, 2006, he was definitely at the top of his career.
Yeah, I mean, he was kind of one of the most respected posters on 2+2 at that time. You know, it was like people just posting really high quality strategy material, and also one of the most feared high stakes cash game opponents. At that time, I believe like 25, 50 games were about the biggest that were running, and Jason was kind of dominating those. So he was a huge influence for both Nate and myself in terms of how we think about poker and how we developed strategically. So it's pretty exciting for us to have the chance to talk to him now, although he's been out of poker for a couple of years. What's he doing now? He's a trader and about to launch his own hedge fund, right?
Yeah, he's in the process of starting his own hedge fund.
And then you've got a hand for us to discuss for today's strategy segment, right?
I do have a hand. I went down to Foxwoods with an old friend a few weeks ago, and we played some 1-2 no limit together. So it's late at night, and it's 1-2 no limit at Foxwoods. There are two limpers, and I'm in the cutoff with about $350 and King 7 suited, and I limp behind.
Let's just stop right there first, because I'm curious. I think I would usually raise this.
Okay.
The circumstance where I wouldn't would be if the limpers were particularly short. I guess if either of them had, I don't know, maybe about 100, somewhere between 120 and 140 would probably be my cutoff where I wouldn't want to raise if that was all that they had. But if they're reasonably deep, 70 big blinds or more, I think I would raise this.
If I had to guess, I think one of them had about $75 and the other one had about 150.
Okay.
Do you think limping is bad?
I mean, it's definitely better than folding.
Folding is terrible, right?
Yeah, folding is out of the question.
Yeah.
I think that, I guess it depends too which guy had $75. The first limper, I'm a lot more concerned about him, either like limp shopping or just the problem with making it shallow is that you don't have as much room to maneuver after the flop. So if these guys, you know, have somewhere in the neighborhood of $140 when you raise it pre-flop, whether or not they fold pre is not that relevant. I would probably just make it like $10 pre. And if that's probably around the point where there's like a 30 to 40% chance of each individual limper folding.
Right.
And, you know, if they fold, obviously that's great. You have King 7. If they don't fold, you may well be ahead of their limp calling ranges, or at least you have pretty decent equity against their limp calling ranges, which are going to include, I think, suited connectors, small pairs, junky aces that you're not ahead of, but you have fine equity against, stuff like that. So you're certainly not going to be in bad shape. You're going to have superior position. And the only reason I wouldn't do it is if I thought there was a good chance of getting limp raised, which I doubt, or if I thought one of them was short enough that there wouldn't be room for my position to matter post-flop. You know, if you make it, if you end up going to the flop with $30 in the pot and one of these guys only has 60 behind, that doesn't really give you a lot of room to maneuver after the flop. You really want room to bet at least two streets. So I wouldn't do it if they were real shallow. But even the second limper, his range is so much weaker than the first limpers that I'd be less concerned about him. But if the first limper was short, I definitely wouldn't want to raise.
That all sounds sensible. I can say that in practice, I do raise this at least somewhat frequently. I had a reason for not doing it at the time, but I forget what that reason is. I do think, in hindsight, that, I mean, especially because I often have a pretty good sense of when I'm going to get limp re-raised, I think that raising is probably superior to just limping behind here, especially because one of the big marks here is the button, who's directly to my left, and he's probably going to come along with about the same hands, or at least with a lot of hands, if I raise. So I'm not going to shut him out of the pot by just calling. So, and I'm glad you agree the folding is bad. So I call, and the button calls. As I said, He's loose. He calls too much. He is suspicious of me. And he's probably playing about 85% of his hands in this spot.
Wow.
Yeah. Any face card, any suited hand, any one gapper, plenty of two gappers. Sometimes if he feels like it. If he's tipping the waitress for a drink, he might just call without looking.
If he played decently post-flop, that wouldn't be so bad. I mean, he's got the button in a limpy 1-2 game, but no, I'm sure he doesn't. But if he played decently post-flop, that calling there with 80% wouldn't be the worst thing in the world.
So that's him. I mean, he's also playing tired, so that makes it even worse, I think. Then my friend... So the main villain in this hand is the small blind. He's a friend of mine. We've played so many hours together going back 9 years now. So he completes the small blind, the big blind checks, and six of us take a flop. So there's $12 minus the rake, so about $10 in the pot going into the flop, which is 6-5-5 with two of my suit.
So you flopped a flush draw on a paired board.
Yeah, I've got a flush draw and two over cards and a three straight. It checks to me. I bet $5. The button calls, my friend calls, and the other three fold. I think I could bet a little bit more, but I didn't.
Nah, I wouldn't bet more.
Okay.
If anything, I'd consider betting less.
Okay.
But probably half pot is good. I think that you should be stabbing here a lot. This is one of the nice things about limping behind, and why I say it wouldn't be so bad for the button to limp behind either, is you're going to end up with a lot of these spots where people are already playing pretty straightforwardly in a 1-2 game anyway, but people are going to play even more straightforwardly in a limp pot, where you're not going to have people just, you know, continuation betting, or everyone's is kind of going to play their hands. So if they check, I mean, there's some chance someone is being trappy by checking, or, you know, check calling a six is very reasonable. You might get people check calling with ace high or something, but you're going to get pretty good information when there's checks around you. I think there's a real fair chance that if you just make a little stab at it, no matter what you have, I mean, here having a flush draw, it's a no-brainer to bet. But I think I would probably bet here with almost anything. And just with the expectation that I'm going to take the pot down. You know, if you bet a third of the pot, you need to win, what, 25% of the time?
Right.
So I think it's pretty plausible that 25% of the time, all these guys are just going to throw it away, or someone is going to make an obviously weak call, and it'll be pretty easy for you to get it away from them later.
Yeah, I think if I had two overcards to the six, I would bet almost all the time.
Yeah, but then if you don't have two overcards, you've got a gut shot.
True.
Or a straight draw, or they have 4-3 or something.
Well, or you have one overcard and nothing, so...
Okay, yeah, I guess with Jack Deuce, I might check.
Yeah, although, do you get to the flop? I don't know. Anyway, so, right.
King Deuce suited, I'm limping here.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, Ace Deuce suited. Queen Deuce, maybe? Probably not.
It would depend. I mean, there's just so much you can get away with when you're dealing with, when you have position on people who don't play well and specifically play very straightforwardly. You just get such good information from having position. You know that it's just hard to make minus EV plays when you have position. And if it's only costing you $2 to see the pot, to see the flop, then even if that call by itself is negative EV, everything that's going to happen afterwards, you're kind of free rolling to see the flop. It's very hard for you to make a mistake after the flop.
It's funny you say that, given that you know what's going to happen this hand.
No one's saying you can't find a way to make a mistake.
Okay. So the turn's a 10, and it completes the flush for me. So 6-5-5-10, I have a king high flush. Pot's about $25. So my friend checks the small blind. I bet 15 into 25. The button calls. And now the small blind raises to $65. I think for a while and call, and the button folds.
So this brings me back to something that we should have talked about on the flop, which is we didn't really talk about what we thought these guys, what it would mean that they called your bet on the flop, which we should have. And I'm sure that you did.
Yeah, so time. I think I put the small blind on a six a lot of the time, or some kind of draw. He's a habitual flop fast player with a big hand. I thought he would bet out or check raise with a five almost all the time, but he just check called. And he could have something like a good draw here, but in terms of draws, I thought like a hand like 7-8 would be more likely than a flush draw, although he definitely could have a flush draw. At the time, I thought he had a six or a draw, and I thought that he would play 7-8 like that almost all the time and a flush draw like that frequently.
So it seems to me that he ought to be check-raising all of his draws. You know, we didn't even talk about what you thought the buttons call meant, but based on
Two overcards.
Exactly. Yeah. Based on your description of him, it seems like we don't have to give the button a lot of credit for having anything. And I was saying that you at least ought to be stabbing at this flop with quite a wide range. So if we look at this at the flop action from your friend's perspective, what he sees is you stabbing at a flop that's pretty hard to hit when a lot of people have checked to you, and then an extremely loose player who is specifically suspicious of you calling on the button. If he has a hand like 7-8 or a flush draw, I don't see why he wouldn't just put in a big check raise here. It seems like it's a perfect semi-bluffing opportunity.
It sounds right. He could think that the six-handed flop gives him reason not to do that, but I do think you're right. And he does like to play the flop fast. So,
yeah. So, I mean, that's that. And I also, just combinatorically, there's so many more ways to have a flush draw than to have exactly 8-7. Even if you think that he's right, a lot more likely to take this line with 8-7 than with a flush draw, he's probably completing, I guess there's some suited combos he would raise from the small blind, but I doubt he's folding any two suited cards pre-flop.
That's
so
right.
So he's going to have so many, even with you holding two, let's just say they're spades. Even with you holding two spades, I still think there's way more combos of spades than there are of 7-8 or 4-3, for that matter, that he's seeing the flop with, just because there's so many more ways to have those suited hands.
I'm not sure he can find a fold for a dollar with 7-4, but...
Yeah, okay, 7-4 for another straight draw.
No, that point's well taken. I probably made a hand-reading mistake here. I did think a 6 was likely.
Yeah, I think a 6 is probably his single most likely holding. Or maybe less than that. I mean, I don't imagine he's... Do you think he folds like pocket deuces?
Yes.
Okay.
He could also lead out with a 6, though. I do think he would at least think about betting out with a 6.
Yeah, I mean, the way I'm thinking about his call is sort of the same way I think about it when the preflop raiser chooses not to make a continuation bet in a spot that's really good for a continuation bet, where it's like, well, you had a great bluffing opportunity and you didn't take it.
Right.
That suggests to me that you don't feel like you need to bluff.
Right.
Which, you know, with a total air hand that he's choosing to just fold, we wouldn't expect him to call. But, you know, with a hand that doesn't have showdown value, but that he's not going to fold, i.e. draws, it seems like he ought to be raising those quite a lot. So when he does call, I'm thinking, I mean, I guess some higher pocket pairs are possible too, like 7s or 8s or something.
Yeah.
Those two, it seems like leading out might be better than check calling those hands. But I guess, you know, we can't say for sure he would have done that. So, yeah, I mean, what I'm thinking when he overcalls the flop is, you know, certainly some chance of a draw. You know, I wouldn't say he never had it, but there's some chance of a draw, a hand with some, you know, solid showdown value that he's not trying to build too big of a pot with, or something that he's trapping with. I know you were saying that he likes to fast play the flop a lot, so I'd actually be a little bit more concerned about a full house rather than trips.
Right.
Because there are a lot of draws on the board. I would think with the trips, he'd be more inclined to fast play them. But of course, it's a lot easier to have trips than it is to have a full house. So I don't know. But I mean, I think you do have to take into consideration a fair chance of him having a pretty strong hand here, just because there's a lot of reasons why he wouldn't take this line with weaker hands.
Yeah. I mean, when he came alive on the turn, I thought there was a good chance he had 6-5, just because I thought he would fast play a 5 more often, and that if he was slow playing, that probably meant he had a full house. So on the turn, I thought he would have the occasional bluff, some flushes, 6-5. That's about it.
So let's talk about your call.
Yeah, I thought I could make a good decision on the river. I thought he could have been taking a shot at me, given that he wouldn't play a flush this way all the time, and that his value range that beats me is pretty narrow. I thought I could afford to call and play the river, especially since I thought I could play the river well against this guy, which is, again, funny.
Do you expect him to be raising worse hands for value? I mean, do you think he has a lower flush than you ever?
Yes, sometimes. I think he could look at that board, decide he couldn't give a free card. Like, if he had 9-3 of spades, then I could see him thinking, you know, Nate could have plenty of things. The button could have anything. I should raise now and not let a 5-6 or spade roll off and just get value. He's generally not.
I mean, it feels a little thin to me for him to be raising with a low flush, but I guess there's not a lot of reason. I mean, we kind of went through on the flop why neither you or the button needed to have much.
Right.
So the only question really is how wide are you going to be barreling the turn after getting called twice on the flop? But this is a pretty good barreling card for you. If we're thinking that the small blinds range is sort of weighted towards weak showdown hands,
right,
like a six or something, you know, this is certainly a good card to barrel to try to get him off of those.
Right.
It may well have improved your equity. Like maybe you have the ace of spades or something,
right,
from his perspective. So this could easily be a good barreling card for you. We know the button doesn't have that much, so there's a lot of incentive for you to barrel to get him out. I guess I can see a friend thinking like, well, you know, I have a sort of vulnerable hand. He's not expecting to get called by worse, I don't think, when he raises a low flush, but I could see him raising it for protection, I guess, or, you know, maybe to get called by trips.
Yeah, I think the button's an underdog to have a pair here.
Even
after calling the flop. When he calls the turn, then he might have a six or something. Or maybe, I mean, he could, like, decide not to raise a 10. I mean, he'll have plenty of 10s just because he would call pre-flop and call the flop with them. I bet he's an underdog to have a pair before he calls the turn, after he calls the turn, whatever.
So, yeah, I mean, your call gets a little better when we can put worse flushes in his range. But, I mean, that also means he's going to have ace-high flushes in his range. And generally, I would say people are more likely to have... Like, the king-high flush is a deceptive hand because it feels like a pretty high flush. In most scenarios, your opponents are going to be playing a lot more combinations of ace-x suited than they are of, you know, two low-suited cards. So generally, like, when you have a king-high flush, let's say your opponent, you somehow knew your opponent had a flush and you didn't know which flush, but you knew he had a flush and you have the king-high flush. Your objective should not be to put a lot of money in the pot, ordinarily.
Yeah.
And that's because there are so many more combos of ace-x suited that most people will play than other students. You know, this is a slightly different situation because with him just completing from the small blind, like we were saying, he's probably doing this with any two suited cards, completing from the small blind. And then once he does, he's not folding the flop. So it does seem like, you know, if we're going to put flushes in his range, he could have a lot of low flushes in addition to ace-x flushes.
But even so, combinatorically, I remember that under conditions of pretty loose pre-flop play, it often comes out still to no better than 50-50. If you have a king high flush and you know the other guy has a flush, about half of them are better, half of them are worse, and that requires loose pre-flop play and a certain kind of board texture, especially if the cards on the board get more spaced out so that you can take suited connectors out of the opponent's range, then often you're an underdog to your opponent's flush range. I remember being really embarrassed when I finally figured that out because it took me way too long to actually sit down and do the math.
Yeah, I definitely recall some hands where I, like, got, you know, I rivered a king high flush and got check raised and tried to, like, shove it for value and ran into the ace.
Yeah.
And in retrospect, it wasn't really such a cooler, or, you know, it wasn't right. Such an unpredictable thing, and I should have just called rather than trying to shovel more money into the pot. But I've definitely lost good sized pots before I understood that concept.
Yeah. It took me playing against a maniac heads up, and I think he raised the river, and I was pretty convinced he would do it with any flush, and then he showed up with a queen high flush, and I thought, like, oh boy, I have such a good edge on the money that went in, and I was pretty sure he had a flush. Then I, like, sat down and did the math, and I had, I think it was like a 53-47 edge on the extra money that went in on the assumption that he had a flush and under reasonable but still, like, very loose preflop ranges for the other guy. Anyway.
Yeah, but then, you know, when you factor in here the very real possibility of him having a full house,
yeah,
which, you know, 10-5 is also in his range.
Yep.
10-5 suited anyway. I think he will be completing that from the small blind. Granted, there's not a ton of combos of that, but I guess the 10 does have to share a suit with one of the 5s, so that helps a little bit in terms of the number of 10-5 combos he can have.
Yeah.
But like 6-5, pocket 6s, pocket 5s, 10-5, I don't imagine pocket 10s. I think he'd be raising those pre-flop.
Or betting him on the flop, yeah.
Yeah, but certainly, you know, a fair number of combos of full houses he can have. I don't really see him doing this with bare trips.
I thought that if he got to the turn like that, he probably would not raise the turn with bare trips. I thought it was a small chance in the first place, but then I thought he would either lead out or check call if he had that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you're getting better than 3-1 to call the turn.
Yeah.
We can, if we put the worst flushes in his range and we think you're not going to make river mistakes,
yeah,
I suppose it's a reasonable call, but I think there should definitely be alarm bells going off where you're like, oh, I'm just trying to show this down cheaply at this point.
Yeah, I almost folded. I almost folded. And I thought, like, as I called, I thought, okay, I can call. There's a good chance I'm going to fold the river. But especially when it's late at night, people give off a lot more physical information, and I've got a pretty good physical read on this guy. So I thought I could make good folding decisions on the river. So the pot's $170 at this point. And it paired the six, so it was 6-5-5-10-6. And my friend checked quickly. And I decided at that point, after he checked quickly, that he probably had to have a flush. And that if he had a flush, he was very likely to have the ace-high flush. So I decided to turn my hand into a bluff, and I bet $85 trying to fold out an ace-high flush.
So what are you trying to represent? What hand do you want him to believe you have? What two cards?
A five, ace-five. I think I would play ace-five, yeah. King-five suited like this. I probably can't have a six, but he's unlikely to have a six also, especially after the turn.
Yeah, it's very plausible that you value about a five here, right? There, I mean, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to represent. Like, the fact that you can't rep a six, I don't think is terribly relevant.
I know at the time, just as a fact about what I was thinking, I was trying to represent a five, and I thought that he was likely to have a flush. So,
I mean, the big question here, because your hand does have some showdown value, you know, that's part of why we were calling on the turn, is that we were saying, well, there's some chance he was just bluffing, and maybe he's got a lower flush. So you're certainly not without showdown value here by checking, or if you think you are, then you should have folded the turn. But you know, assuming that the turn call was good, then there is real money to be made by just checking behind the river. Certainly, I think it's reasonable to make him fold ace-high flushes. I think that's a reasonable objective. And the question is, how likely is he to show up with a better hand? You know, will it be enough to outweigh the times that you fold him off of a $170 pot? So you're betting half the pot. You're going to need him to fold better hands in a, like a 2-to-1 ratio with the times that he shows up with, or about half as often as he shows up with hands better than yours, right?
Right. And then every once in a while, he could have a flush and get suspicious and call. I don't think that'll happen.
Call you with a lower flush, you mean?
Yeah. Once in a great while, I could call and win. And I think he never bluffs me off the best hand.
I mean, surely the possibility of you getting called and winning also opens up the possibility of you getting called by ace-high flushes.
Yes.
Right. If he's occasionally calling with lower flushes, he's presumably more occasionally calling with higher flushes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that it's not really a net good thing for you that he'll occasionally get suspicious and call with flushes.
No, but I already knew he would call with a flush sometimes. I already think it's possible that he's going to call with a flush. I just think that if he has, I guess I'm running the same reasoning you're running in the opposite direction, given that I think it would be unreasonable to think that he's going to fold an ace-high flush all the time. But if he's going to call with an ace-high flush sometimes, he's going to call with other flushes at least a little bit of the time, which I think it's only a small consideration. But
so I will say, I think that I don't see a lot of reason for him to check a full house on the river.
Yeah.
The only reason to do that would be to induce a bluff from you.
Right.
And I don't think he's anticipating you turning a flush into a bluff.
Right.
I mean, it's actually a reason for doing it, because this is kind of close to the bottom of your range. And from a game theory perspective, it makes sense to bluff with whatever the bottom of your range is.
Right.
And this is probably actually one of the weakest hands with which you see the turn. I'm sorry, with which you see the river.
Yes.
So there is that argument for bluffing as well.
Yeah, I do think sometimes if he had 6-5, you know, usually I think he's too good for this. I think he's too thoughtful to attribute this kind of reasoning to him, but it was pretty late at night, and I wouldn't put it past him to just sort of reflex check, thinking that he has the deck crippled if he had 6-5, then the river paired the 6. I agreed with you at the time that he had little reason to check a full house. I did think there was some chance that he could still have 6-5 after he checked, but I thought it was more likely that he had a flush, and specifically an ace-high flush.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's more of a case, actually, for him checking a hand that can beat 5s full, because you certainly ought to value out of 5 if checked to. So if he has 6s full or better, I could see him, although it's awfully hard for him to have 6s full, but if he does, I could see him going for a river check raise.
Yeah.
Although I'm still not sure it's better than betting, but I really don't see the logic for him to check a 5, which is his most likely. Yeah, I guess I would feel pretty good about bluffing this, because I do think that the likelihood of him having a full house is pretty small once he checks the river. So it's just a matter of, like, you know, getting him to fold ace-high flushes more often than he calls with them would be my biggest decision point.
Yeah. And I thought I mean, he's not in the habit of making big folds to me, but at the same time, you know, I've shown a lot of strength to get this far. I don't have a big history of turning made hands into bluffs, and I think at a 1-2 no limit game, he's not going to be thinking too much about people turning king high flushes into bluffs.
And I think your sizing is good here, right? I think this is an appropriate amount to bet and what you probably ought to bet if you had a five. So I think your sizing is good.
I mean, all things considered, do you like the bluff?
I like the river bet. So you want to give us the results?
I was surprised he had a naked five, which I thought he couldn't have on the flop. I thought he would almost always lead out or check raise. In fact, I think he fast plays the flop almost too much with his best hands. And then on the turn, when the flush comes, I didn't think there was any reason to check raise a naked five into a flush board like that. But that's what he had. On the drive home, I talked with him about this at some length, and I asked him what was going on the flop, and he just said, yeah, I don't know. He just chalked it up to a performance error, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I dislike his play a lot more than I dislike yours.
I think he played this hand badly. I think he thinks he played this hand badly. I think his turn raise is not good.
I agree, and I don't like his river check either.
No.
The flop I don't mind so much, because I think both you and Button can be awfully light here. I mean, you definitely can have a lot of draws. Like, there's good reason for him to raise here for value and protection, but, I mean, you both can have a lot of air also, and it sounds like there is at least a fair chance for Button. You are probably not going to, like, all of a sudden turn a pair and go crazy with it. Button very well could. You know, if Button does have like Jack 10 or something here, maybe you have nothing, but this could easily go down where the turn is not a spade. He check raises the turn, and Button has turned a pair and now, you know, calls the turn check raise and calls a river bet, whereas he would have just folded to a flop check raise. And then, you know, there's also just kind of the merit of like mixing it up on the flop. And here, you know, it led us to exclude those hands from his range and end up putting about $150 more in the pot than we might have if we thought fives were a bigger part of his flop calling range. So I don't mind his flop play that much. I agree that the turn check raise is not real good. I mean, it's just there's a pretty good chance that someone has a flush, and he ought to be happy enough just to call and see the river, I think. I think it's a lot more important to avoid putting money into the pot against the flush than it is to charge flush draws and occasional better full house draws. I'm not a big fan of the river check either, just because I don't think you're going to value bet an ace high flush if it's checked to you. I don't think you should. So it's like, what's he hoping that you do? Turn a king high flush into a bluff? I mean, he happened to hit the variance jackpot that you went for that, but I don't think it's a good thing for him to plan on. Like, the only merit of check calling would be to induce bluffs. Surely your calling range on the river is wider than your value betting range. Yeah, so the conclusion here is he's a bigger fish than you are.
Yeah, although he's won so much money off me over the last decade. Yeah, he's...
Who's the playwright? Whose pen is the card? When God's screenwriting...
We're here today with Jason Strasser. You've heard us talk about his poker accomplishments, both over the felt and on the theory end of things. He's also a very nice guy, and now a Wall Street finance whiz. Thanks for coming on the show, Jason. Could you start by walking us through your transition from poker into finance?
Yeah, sure. It all kind of started when I basically had no expectations of going into finance in 2006. I was an engineering student, and I had bad grades because I spent a lot of time playing poker and that kind of thing, and I just wasn't that into my major at school. I did fine, but nothing special. And, you know, I had the conversation with my parents where I told my Jewish mother that I was going to be a professional poker player, and obviously that was a heart attack situation for her. But my mind was made up on doing poker. And then what happened was a bunch of the banks, you know, and I would say the interview process started around, like, November. It was, like, November 2006. All the banks came to Duke to interview. And I basically thought there was no way I could get a job. But I figured I'd interview because everyone told me, you know, they all told me I could get a job, number one. And number two, you know, it's really easy to get back into poker. It's much harder to find a path into a career like finance. So I figured, you know, I'd give it a shot. If I end up getting a job, maybe I'll think about taking it because I can always just drop my job and go back to poker. That was my thinking. So I ended up interviewing. My first round interview was on the best day of my life. It was on the middle of the W Coupe. I mean, it's kind of a cool story, but we can get into it when we can't. But it was basically I won. I scooped a W coupe for $440K. It finished around 5 in the morning on that Monday, and I had a 7 a.m. interview with Morgan Stanley that same day. So I showed up to the interview a little bit. I was so excited. I didn't give a crap what happened in that interview. I showed up. I was smiling. I said, "Listen, whatever happens to this interview, I'm probably having the best day of my life." And turns out the guy interviewing me was an avid poker player. And we got off really well, and he invited me back to New York. I met with some people there, and I got a job offer. So, and I took it because I figured I can always quit. It's hard to get back into trading or anything like that, and it's kind of a young person's game. You know, you don't see too many people getting into trading in their early 30s. It's very much a young person's game. So that's sort of how I got involved. And I spent my first 4 years at Morgan Stanley in the equity derivatives desk, and I started off trading tech, media, and telecom options, and then I moved over to trade industrials and materials options. Then I quit to join a hedge fund about last summer, and in January, I quit the hedge fund to start my own hedge fund with a couple other guys. So that's sort of where I am with finance, but it definitely was not one of those things that I had mapped out. It sort of just evolved like that.
So when you say you're trading options in such an industry, what exactly is that? And what's your day-to-day life? So if you tell me that you're trading option, like tech options, what exactly does that mean? And what does that mean that you do?
It's sort of like two things. So number one, say, Nate, you open up an E-Trade account and you go and you want to trade an option on Microsoft. You want, options, without getting too far into options, they're basically the right to buy and sell a stock at a future date. So let's say Microsoft's trading at 30 and you buy the option to buy it for 35 in a year, right? That option is worthless unless Microsoft goes above 35. And then suddenly, instead of buying it for where it is in the market, you can buy it for 35. So that option has value. So what happens is every time someone trades an option or a stock, there's someone on the other side of the trade. Usually it's a computer. But in the case of what I was doing, we were trading very, very big option trades. So the biggest customers in the world, so let's say you're a pension plan, a hedge fund, an asset manager, some guy who has a lot of money. And when they go to trade options, they need someone to make them a price on a lot of them. And that's not something right now, at least, computers can do as well. So what we would do is basically someone would come in, they probably were thinking about this option trade for years and years and years and years, or years, I'm being dramatic, but they probably thought it out for a long time. They would come into Morgan Stanley, and we would have to give them a price in like a minute. And it's very much, in terms of the mechanics of it, it's not that different than what a bookie does.
Okay.
You're sort of like, you're the house. Somebody comes in, they have probably a little bit more information than you about that stock, but you tell them you put a price out there and you try to capture the theoretical edge versus what you think the fair value is. So it's sort of like that's part of what we did at Morgan Stanley. And then the other half is we made our own bets based off of what we thought was going to happen in the future. So if we thought a stock was going to go up or down, or we thought a stock was going to move or not going to move, we would use options to make those bets. So those are the two things that we did. But my day-to-day was, I'd wake up at those times I wake up pretty early, probably 6 in the morning. I'd read the paper, hop in the shower, get to work by 6:45, 7. We had meetings in the morning. We would sort of strategize. I started in 2007 when it was the height of the market, and I went through 2008, which was a complete and utter disaster for anyone associated with, it was a disaster for everyone, period, but especially for people in the financial services industry. And, I went through all that, layoffs and all that crazy stuff. But, the day-to-day definitely changed throughout 2008. When Lehman Brothers was collapsing and all that drama was going down and Morgan Stanley almost went under, that was obviously my day-to-day was a lot different during those periods. But, I wake up in the morning, the market's open at 9:30, so the morning was a lot of reading, a lot of meetings, talking with our salespeople, talking about different clients that we're doing a good job with or we're not doing a good job with. And then when the market opened, it's one of those things where the one big difference between the markets and poker is that the amount of variables in the market is just way higher. So things happen in the market that you didn't even know was possible all the time.
Like what?
So I'll give you an example. So I was Thanksgiving, let me get the year right. I think it was 2010. I had a lot of stuff in my book, and I went off to Thanksgiving it was a long weekend, and normally nothing happens in the market. And it came out over that weekend that Dubai had defaulted on a loan. I forget the size of the loan. It was a big loan. But Dubai basically ran out of money. And Dubai is like a big, you know, they got really hit hard in the recession. And finally, it came to a head, and they ran out of money. And the stock market was trading down 3 or 4% over the weekend during Thanksgiving. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, there's no equivalent to poker in this. I mean, this is literally like, I mean, Black Friday is close,
right.
but this is like the equivalent of you playing online poker and then, you know, your chips just disappearing for some reason you never heard of, you know, because of some rule you never heard of or whatever.
Sure.
You know, it's just there's just so many more variables in markets than there are in poker. So there are really interesting things about that because things happen that, you know, if you even look back to earlier this week, on Monday, a firm called Knight Trading had an algorithm go wrong. And they were basically sent all these crazy buy and sell orders to the market between 9:30 and 9:35 in the morning. And all these, I mean, I remember I was looking at Boyd Gaming, which is the company that owns the Borgata, and the stock was trading up 20% in the morning. And there was no news out, there was nothing happening. And I was like, what? It was a stock that I definitely cared about. And there were all these crazy things happening. And it turns out they turned off the algorithm by 9:35. The firm lost $440 million in 5 minutes, which was four times what they make in a year.
Wow.
And they were basically exploring bankruptcy options within that day. And that shows you, like, those crazy moves in the morning that happened with those stocks, there's no way there's no possible explanation for what happened. But things like this in finance happen all over the time. So that's the big difference with poker. Like, you know, you can get a runner-runner, you know, whatever. But that's something you can, you know, plan for. There are things in finance you just can't plan for. So, yes, part of what makes finance exciting is that aspect, is that you can take the smartest math guy in the world, but he can't model some of the things that happen in the world. You know, and the best traders are not the smartest people in the world. I mean, it's a really good mix of people that understand math and understand probability and odds and all that, but also you need to have street smarts and you need to sort of adjust to what's going on around you. And that's why I still, you know, when I talk to poker players, I still tell them, like, you know, now is a really, really miserable time to get involved in trading, but it's still a really good option for a lot of people out there because there aren't many careers that will embrace the skill set you have now, like trading and finance.
So let's say I'm a poker player and I want to get into finance. Like, what's my first step?
It really depends. Like, I mean, the easiest situation is if you're in school. So if you're in school, I mean, there are a lot of people that will hire kids out of school. You know, you have a leg up if you're in school right now. There's a lot of things you can do, obviously, depending on what school you have. You know, there are things that make your life easier. You know, good grades, for one, definitely make your life easier. But, I mean, the kind of way, if you're still in school, you know, I would say, you know, a lot of these banks and financial institutions and hedge funds or whatever will come to your school to interview. Like, that's the best way. That's the easiest and best way of going about it. If you're sort of, you know, 3 years out of school, you've played poker for a while, you either dropped out of college or don't have great grades or whatever, you know, the route's a little different, but it's not this impossible route that no one can take. You know, it involves a lot of sort of teaching yourself, it involves a lot of reading books, it involves a lot of networking. It's sort of that kind of path. But the bottom line is, like, in finance, it's all about making money. And if you can be helpful to someone who's trying to make money, you there's a place for you. I mean, once I got into the industry, nobody asked me what my GPA was anymore. No one cared where I went to school. It doesn't matter. It's not. There are so many people in this industry that got to where they were by really unconventional means. It's an industry that embraces sort of, you know, it's not like, you know, a lot of these corporate jobs people take, you know, you got to go to business school. If you don't have that, it prevents you from moving up the ladder. There's really nothing like that in finance. If you're talented and you're good and you work hard and you catch a lucky break and you're able to break in with the right situation, no one's going to care that you spent 3 years playing poker. No one gives a crap.
I'm surprised to hear you. I mean, you mentioned a couple times like that you felt like trading was a young man's game, or it's easier to get into straight out of college. But you're also saying that it's the kind of thing where, if you use the term street smarts or kind of familiarity with the way the world works, it seems like those two things are in tension with each other. You're talking about there's kind of these unpredictable factors that you need to be aware of. It seems like you're saying that experience or worldliness would be valuable there.
Right. I mean, what I meant by that is not necessarily experience with financial markets or anything like that. Because when you get hired out of school, you know, the last thing people are looking for is experience or that kind of thing. They want raw talent. But what I was trying to say is that, like, poker players, you know, you line up your average poker player against your average Harvard 4.0, you know, econ major. If you line up the pros and cons, the poker player is much more likely to be sort of street smart, savvier, better at adjusting to things that don't go right. A lot of these kids that come in, you know, when I was at Morgan Stanley, we would have these, you know, kids show up with these fancy resumes and whatever. But the minute something went wrong, they really didn't have much experience with that. I don't know how to describe that, but, like, a lot of these kids just never really failed at anything. And, you know, trading is failing. You fail all the time. And poker players are what I meant by street smart are more able to sort of keep their mind focused, and also, like, they're a little more skeptical in nature. If things aren't working, if poker players are really used to constantly analyzing their own thought process. So, like, a really good poker player doesn't, you know, is not, obviously not results oriented, but they're constantly reevaluating the process of how they approach situations. And that's sort of what I mean by street smarts. Like, poker players are really naturally more inclined to do things like that, where I think you take one of these fancy Harvard kids, I'm not saying at Harvard here, but a fancy Ivy League kid, they're more stubborn in nature than what I had to say, generalization.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was curious too, Jason. You were saying before you kind of felt like you could get back into poker if you needed to, and it doesn't sound like that's anything you're really looking to do. But I know you do still play poker from time to time. I think I remember you've been running into you on PokerStars back when you could do that. Occasionally. I mean, are you finding it as easy as you thought it would be to just sit back down at the poker table, or, I mean, are you still playing with some of the best people in the world? Do you feel like you're behind when you do sit down with them?
Oh, I mean, the talent of people playing poker now is just mind-boggling. When I say I get back into poker, that's what I thought in 2006. There's no way, I'm not even close to where people are right now. You know, when I play poker now, I play in these New York games, you know, once or twice a week. And I'm playing with people that I'm better than for the most part. But for me to sort of make the transition from where I am now back into poker, which I really don't think I'm going to be making, it would be a very difficult process for me because, poker's like one of those things where it evolves every year. You see the same, you know, you see a couple of the same players, you know, playing in the big games, but behind the scenes, like, you know, it seems to me like you have a new young players overthrowing less young, less good players every year. That's sort of the cycle of poker. You know, you look at the players that are playing in these big stakes games now, like, most of them 2 years ago were nowhere. You look at, like, you know, Sauce or, I don't know, all these guys playing these massive games now. I swept these things. I don't even know who these guys are. But it's new players every time. You know, every 2 years I go on High Stakes DB and look, it's a whole new set of players that are killing it. And I think that's just the nature of the game. And for me to get back to any type of level versus the competition where I was before, it would be an extremely, extremely difficult process. So, I mean, I think I'm downright mediocre by today's standards. I think when I go to Vegas and I play 25-50 at the Bellagio, I mean, there are a handful of players that are without any question better than I am. So I think poker's evolved and players are just so good right now. And I talk to my friends. I have a lot of friends that are still, you know, in the game and all that stuff, and that's what they're telling me. You know, these are the smartest people in the world, and they're telling me that, you know, 2-4-6 max no limit on PokerStars is, like, really hard to beat. And I'd have to see that to believe it, but I think that when I thought I could get back into poker, I imagined it would be an easier transition than if I actually had to make that transition today.
I think you actually may have had a lot to do with the people today getting as good as they were. Because, I mean, I do still hear people reference, I mean, in particular, I think it was a 2+2 post that you made about things that you're trying to accomplish at the table. The one that sticks in my head in particular was, I really want to be a pain in the ass to the guy on my right. You know, like, I want him to hate having me sitting on his left. And just kind of things like that. You know, the not stuff as broad as, like, I want to be able to clear that light, but just sort of like the thing, or I think it was things that you feared about your opponents or the kind of people you didn't like to play against. And I know that was a really influential post, probably, I mean, still for a lot of people who are at the top of the poker world now. I mean, I think some of the things that you were writing and saying in the 2003 to 2006 era probably did a lot to influence those people.
Yeah, I mean, the way I sort of class, like, and I appreciate that, like, I have a lot of sort of, you know, and I'm sure a lot of people with good reason would point to a lot of sort of leaks in my game and things I did wrong back then. And I agree with them. Like, there, I would do things now. I mean, you could look at my, you know, VPIP back then, you know, it was very, very high. There were certainly things I was doing that were wrong. But I think the thing I did well back then was I really did, apply pressure and make people uncomfortable. And so even though I did things that were definitely mistakes, just flat out either mathematical or logic mistakes, I still, my people just played really bad against me because I would do things like that. And, you know, a guy would raise and I would three bet him eight hands in a row. And, you know, things like that, still to this day, when I play a live poker tournament or when I'm playing cash games, I do things that I think will stand out to other players as really make them uncomfortable. And I do that. So when I play the World Series of Poker, sometimes I'll sit there, you know, and I didn't get to play this year at all, but I think I've played the main event maybe three out of the last 5 years or something like that. You know, sometimes I'll play a guy and I'll just three bet him every time he opens. Or I'll cold four bet a guy twice in a row or something like that. And I just find that I get very good results when I put people in spots where they look at me and they've never seen this kind of thing before, and they don't react well to it. And I guess that's sort of a microcosm of why I was successful, and a microcosm of why today, if I got back in the game, I'd have a lot of adjustments to make. Because right now, if I pulled any of that stuff, these players would adjust very, 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 very well to that. So it would have to be a way different approach.
The quote I remember from you was, "When I'm playing at my best, my opponents fold suspiciously."
Yeah, that's probably right.
Let's say you could go back in time to the boom era and give your former self one piece of advice. What would that be?
If I could give Jason Coker advice, yeah, you know, I would say the one thing I did really well back then was that I put in the hours, and I knew, I just had a feeling, you know, my parents are journalists, and they work very hard, and, you know, they make very good money, but, you know, I would be, you know, I was making a lot of money in poker at one time, and, you know, I just remember them being so shocked by it, and you know, a lot of people sort of get disconnected from the real world, but throughout the whole poker thing, when I was making the money I was making, I thought to myself that it was temporary. I had that attitude in my mind. I was like, this is, I'm a smart guy, but I'm not, nothing that I'm doing now is incredibly mind-blowing. You know, there's no reason people can't catch up to me in the future, what I'm doing now. And because of that, I did put in a lot more hours than other people. So that was one thing I did well. I would say if I could give myself some more poker advice, it would be that to reemphasize the fact that it's temporary and remind myself that what I was doing at the time wasn't anything that was like, it was a little bit ahead of the curve, but it wasn't anything that other people couldn't catch up and do. And I also, I think I would have game select a little better if I could go back in time. You know, I have that attitude where I played anybody. And I think now it's taken to a ridiculous extreme now because, you know, I remember I would have like 2 hours a week to play poker and I'd want to play heads up 5-10 no limit on PokerStars and I couldn't get a game. And I had to show up as a fish to some of these people. I hadn't even played poker for 3 years. People, these bump hunting stuff is taking to an extreme the other way. But, you know, back then I would just play anybody. There was nobody I thought that I couldn't beat playing. And I think if I go back, that was a little bit arrogant, and I would have made more money if I had avoided a couple situations that were just bad game selection decisions.
Well, I want to thank you for your time. So thanks a lot, and good luck with everything you're doing.
thanks again to Jason for coming on. That was really cool for me anyway to get a chance to talk to him. I guess maybe some people were going to be more familiar with the trading industry than we were, but I've always had only a vague idea of what some of that stuff meant. So it was interesting for me to hear that side of the conversation as well, what it means to trade derivatives and what that means he does on a daily basis. I found all that pretty interesting. It's, you know, initially he made this comment about he thought it'd be easy to get back into poker. Like he could just kind of take a flyer and see if the trading thing worked out. And if it didn't, he could always get back into poker later. And I was surprised when he said that at the time. And then later it seemed like he did. It seemed like he was acknowledging that was a miscalculation on his part, that maybe it wouldn't be so easy, which that seems right to me, the second, because even for me, you know, now that I have been playing not nearly as much since Black Friday, I found when I do go out to play like the W Coupe or the Scoop or something, I'm playing a lot better by the end of the series than I am in the beginning, just kind of as a matter of being rusty. But I've also noticed some big changes in the way people are playing, even just from like a year ago. The amount of 3 and 4 betting that's going on in tournaments now, it feels a lot more like what cash games felt like maybe a year to two ago. Like that whole 3 and 4 betting light trend really picked up in cash games maybe 2 years ago. And I feel like now it's come pretty full force to tournaments where there's so many just like random people, like basically everyone at a random like $200 W Coupe table will be, you know, will have a 3-bet of like 8 to 10%, which you just didn't used to see.
Right. Right.
You don't know that initially, you know, like I'm accustomed to saying, well, if some random in a tournament 3-bets me, his range is somewhat stronger and he doesn't have certain hands in his range. Like there's kind of a lot of default assumptions I was making that turned out not to be true just as a result of my not being as familiar with the tournament metagame.
Right. Do you think that you're rusty as a player also? I mean, I think this, I haven't played a hand online since April of last year or so, since Black Friday. And definitely when I play live, I think I'm rusty.
Yeah, I definitely am. I actually don't find it as much live. I don't know. Like I haven't played a ton of live poker. I wasn't thrilled, I guess, with my play at the WSOP, but I didn't really think that was due to rustiness. And then, you know, I went to Vegas again a couple weeks after that and just played some cash games at Encore. And I felt very comfortable there. I mean, I won every single session that I played, and some of them were tough games. Well, not tough, but, you know, not super soft games.
Right.
And I always felt like I was pretty well in control of the situation. I just think live poker, people are a lot more manipulable and a lot more of my default assumptions still applied. I think the online arena changes much faster.
Okay. I also don't think it would be easy to get back into poker. Yeah, I have trouble when I play more than I used to. And I don't know. That's okay.
I did still ultimately have a pretty successful W Coupe. I mean, there's plenty that you don't forget. And it is, I mean, certainly I'm warming up a lot more quickly than I would if I were going from cold. But there was a warm-up period. I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that a lot of my best runs occurred late in the W Coupe. I think there probably were a few things I could have done better earlier in the W Coupe, where certainly not a guarantee that I would have gone deeper, but I could have given myself a better chance. And I was not playing as well in the first couple events as I did at the end.
No, it all seems right. I thought one of the most interesting parts of the interview was Jason's description of what poker does to you psychologically, or maybe the sorts of psychological virtues you tend to find in people who are drawn to poker, things like honest self-evaluation and the ability to adjust and a sort of heavy dose of skepticism.
And resilience, like being able to accept things going wrong. That was one that really jumped out at me when he was saying there's so many people who have been had a privileged background where they never really had anything go wrong before. And like I was saying, with him being able to roll with the punches when he loses aces, ace king suited for a huge pot day four of the main event, like that sort of thing. Yeah, that's a super valuable life skill.
A lot of what he was talking about goes under what gets called meta rationality, which is one of my big interests, really, is sort of the ability to view yourself from the outside and gather information about yourself as if you were looking at another person and then using that to adjust. So, like the same way that you don't believe the moon's a foot wide anymore because you understand that things far away appear smaller, or, you know, the stick that looks bent in the water isn't bent, you know, you correct for that. And in the same way, you can do that about belief formation and your own practices. I think this is something that's an under-recognized skill and that poker players are much, much better than average at, and that poker gets you really good at, because, you know, I just know that I'm going to want to call more late at night, and I know that when I'm stuck, I'm going to be naturally disposed to play more hands and gamble with draws a little bit more. And that's just something, of course, as time goes by, you have those feelings less and less, but you also learn to correct for them. And I think that's something that goes on in everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's a good chance that just saved my life. About 6 months ago, I was driving up the 95 through Providence, and I remember thinking, like, boy, I feel comfortable right now, but, you know, there are all these curves, and people tend to drive a little bit crazy, and even though I feel comfortable, I'm probably less attentive than I need to be, so I really ought to double down on attention, you know? But then, about 30 seconds later, the car next to me started swerving off the road and ended up coming right in front of me, and probably would have taken me out if I hadn't been, like, super aware, so...
Wow.
Yeah. So that's how poker saved my life.
Yeah, we could talk forever about this, but I feel like driving is a place where so many people are irrational.
Yeah, it's a huge leak. I think people don't realize how big a difference it is between a 1% chance of getting into an accident in the next 3 months and a 0.5% chance of getting into the same kind of accident over the same time period.
Yeah, I mean, if you kind of think about the pot odds of it, like what the potential loss.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the very real possible consequences is the loss of your life. So even when you're talking about very small or the loss of someone else's life, I mean, I think I would be possibly even like, I feel like if you told me you're going to be in a car accident, would you rather kill yourself or someone else? Like snap call myself. So yeah, I mean, the stakes when you're dealing with human lives are such that, like you're saying, the difference between, you know, being slightly more attentive or slightly more cautious is huge.
And I mean, I think coming full circle, I think this is part of the value of poker, where you really critically analyze a lot of things. I mean, poker is also pretty good at teaching you to value low probability events in like EV calculations. Like if you enter a tournament, like if you enter the main event, it makes a big difference whether you have a 1 in 5,000 or 1 in 10,000 chance of winning, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's something poker teaches you. I think it really teaches you to go beyond appearances and find active ways to improve your life. And it helps you in trading too, I guess. So that's thanks again to Jason, and thank you to all our listeners, especially everyone who's written in with feedback and questions. We appreciate it, and there's nothing better for a podcast in its infancy. Finally, thanks to Phil of The Saturday Giant, whose music you've been listening to. You can go to thesaturdaygiant.com, download some albums and pay whatever you want for them, and check out some tour dates. He's playing 30 shows all over the Northeast, starting and ending in Ohio, and going many places, including Boston and New York in between. So thanks to him. Until next week, here's a song called Who Can Recall His Past Lives?
Of your mind, oh. considering that you're a ghost monkey trying to teach us all something. Though we're huddled in these dark woods trembling, surrounded on all sides by hungry eyes and Cheshire grins. Seems to me that it might be worth considering that we're just humble monkeys wishing for deliverance. Though we're scrambling through dark woods trembling, you're a turner.